Spy Guys are still under a judicial estrangement order. That blue thing I got from her.
I've got the best lawyer soft tacos can buy.
Objection.
On what grounds?
How about silliness, Your Honor?
I think legal terms are magic words that can force people to do what I want.
My client has instructed me to remind the court how rich and important he is, and that he is not like other men.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 419. Oh, geez, we're one away from 420. That'll be fun.
I got Thomas. That joke.
Yeah. It's not even really a joke anymore. It's so dumb, but it's funny to me that everybody is like, yeah, 69, 420. It's like, anyway, I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm good. So listeners will be able to, next episode, they can play episode 69 and then 420, and then maybe there's a hidden message if you do that. I'm just saying. All these jokes will be great next week when we do that episode. Okay. We've got updates on Wisconsin and comments and questions. There's a lot more to say there, I think. And then the main segment today is a deep dive on McGirt v. Oklahoma. And I know, Andrew, you promised that deep dive a while back, and unlike Eminent Domain, we're actually doing it.
We are.
Cool. Cue the listener comments segment going 70 minutes and then we run out of time. No, we're really getting
to it. That
would
be amazing. That would be funny. I kind of want us to do that now.
No, we can just say, here, we'll fix it. And the wild card segment is Eminent Domain. We'll see if we get to that. Okay, now we'll get to it. We'll get to McGirt v. Oklahoma. All right, let's get to our first segment.
What I hear when I'm being yelled at is people caring loudly at me.
We had a couple commenters who were probably more upset by my naming the episode, and I'll go ahead and take the if there is blame, I'll take it. But I'll take the accountability for the episode names. Usually I am forced to do that, so I called it the Kenosha Terrorist.
Forced, I like that.
Yeah, and you know, I think, and we talked a little bit about this on the Q&A, but I think that, you know, putting it out on the main show is probably a good idea too. It might be true that the Kenosha shooter was not your typical, you know, white nationalist or incel with a hit list and a manifesto out to just go intentionally shoot people. I think it's fair to say that this 17-year-old kid was not precisely that kind of terrorist, but I think I stand by the episode name because when you are a white Trump supporter and you arm yourself illegally, by the way, illegally arm yourself and drive across state lines to go defend property that isn't yours from Black Lives Matter protesters, I, in my opinion, and this is my opinion and I'll stand by it, you are engaging in the centuries old white terrorism that you are part of that long process of scaring people who want to maybe just have some civil rights away from engaging in and utilizing their right of protest. I think you are participating in that, especially when you end up killing two people, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So I stand by that name, though with a caveat that, you know, it's not as though he was one of these shooters you see who's like, I'm going to go kill a bunch of people today. Like, okay, there's a small distinction there. Maybe in his mind, he wasn't 100% going to murder people that day, for whatever that's worth. But what do you think about it?
I'll say a couple of things. Number one, like I said on the Q&A, I think when you travel across state lines with an assault weapon in response to what appears to be, as far as we can tell, radical right-wing requests for
call
people
to
do that.
Yeah.
Right, a call to arms. That's exactly right. Like, your job there is to spread terror. And so I think that is an accurate assessment. And as I said on the Q&A, I support the naming then. I support it now. I think that you are right to draw the distinction that you're doing there, right? Which is to say, yes, that there is a difference between a 17-year-old kid who was radicalized by right-wing extremism and the people creating the propaganda in the first place, right? I think that's an important distinction. I think that highlights how important it is, you know, not to be vigilant about these kinds of things, right? So, you know, it isn't. We're the party on the left, right? So we are supposed to understand a series of causes, but that doesn't mean that we can't decry those underlying causes. And the underlying causes are very, very clearly racism. And I would encourage you, if you're thinking about, when you talk about the history of white terrorism against black people, do a Google search for the Wilmington Massacre. That's what comes to mind. And in particular, you can find, if you type in Isaac Stanley Becker, that is a hyphenated last name, Isaac Stanley Becker, you can read about the only violent coup that ever took place on American soil. Mm. And to summarize it, it was immediately after the Civil War, at the end of the 19th century, and white Republicans collaborated with black voters. They elected a handful of aldermen in the city of Wilmington, North Carolina, and the Democrats made race the explicit issue of their statewide campaign across North Carolina the next year. They were swept into power, but like a handful of those black aldermen remained in power in the city of Wilmington. And as a result, the Democrats issued the, quote, White Declaration of Independence.
What, like, got together a mob. They actually called it that?
They called it the White Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, back when things weren't all PC, guys.
Yeah, they marshaled 2,000 armed men. First, they marched on the city's African-American newspaper, which was called the Daily Record, and burned it to the ground. Then they went to the Capitol and killed 300 black people, rode the rest out of the state. The article uses the phrase premeditated acts of terrorism, which I think are correct. Incidentally, there were no white casualties as a result of this insurrection. And the reason it's called an insurrection or a coup is that the Republican mayor, the three black aldermen, the African-American chief of police were all either killed or forced to resign, and they were replaced with the white leaders who led the rebellion. And by the way, those people were reelected the next year, 1899, and they passed a whole bunch of Jim Crow laws, making it difficult or de facto illegal for black people to vote. So, there's your recap. Read the whole story. But when black people managed to get a handful of folks elected in Wilmington, North Carolina, white people gathered up a militia and overthrew them by force in what can fairly and legally be called the only successful coup on American soil in American history.
Wow.
So there you go.
I want to run this one by you. One thing that I've gathered from a lot of people on the right lately is that they're really playing up the, like, well, businesses are burned, businesses are looted, blah, blah, blah. And on one hand, I'm not in favor of just anyone who's out there capitalizing on mayhem and stealing stuff for no reason and blah, blah, blah. And obviously some of that's out there. Now, other parts of it might be an expression of the disgusting income inequality in this country that we need to fix. as Amazon is becoming, you know, a $1 trillion company and all that. And meanwhile, people are starving. People don't have health care. People are not making a living wage. So, you know, I kind of feel like there may be some, if not logic to it, I understand it. But I just have to say, Andrew, you're a business guy. You consult businesses. Don't businesses usually have insurance? In fact, isn't it usually a requirement of opening an establishment that you have some insurance? And if, you know, I get that it's not great if someone burns down your business. I understand. I wouldn't love it. But like, we're talking on one hand, human lives, you know, like on one hand, Kyle Rittenhouse needs to go murder people in cold blood to protect a car dealership. And on the other hand, we have, let's say something bad happens, which also, by the way, happens all the time after sporting events when someone's team wins the championship or whatever. Cars are flipped over, businesses are burned. There's a thing called insurance. That's just money that can be replaced, right? Like, it's like these people have never heard of insurance.
So let me try and steel man the other side as much as I can, right? Because look, I agree with the general principle that it is not equivalent to equate property loss with loss of human life, right? And I would add the additional point that you didn't quite make, but I think is implicit in that, which is I think there's also a difference between protecting your family home and protecting your business. So the argument to the contrary is business insurance is often like all of our collective experience with insurance in other contexts, right?
Sure.
And I say this as somebody who represented insurance companies for 2 decades, right? It, you know, could you still suffer a loss as a result of that because the insurance company is making it difficult for you to collect on your policy or what?
Yeah.
Those, I just want to acknowledge that those are real arguments. I have been very public and I remain on this place, but that I recognize the privilege inherent in my belief in protesting, which is, you know, I think protests should be nonviolent and I think protests should not like attack and burn down other people's properties. And, you know, that's but I'm also cognizant of the position of privilege that comes from. So those are the arguments that I would muster, but I don't see how any of that gets you to a kid reading InfoWars and saying, hey, Ma, I want you to let me take this illegal firearm and transfer me across the border and drop me off.
Protect a car dealership.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
That seems, I don't get it. And I want to add as a point of hypocrisy that the Republican voices who are papering over the fact that he committed multiple felonies before Kyle Rittenhouse started firing a single shot, right, are the same people that lump all undocumented aliens into the category of illegal immigrants, right? Again, these people have violated, paper statutes regarding how you fill out your application. And many times what they've done is they've overstayed a student visa. So yeah, they are quote illegal. Well, you know, if everybody who breaks a law gets dumped into the same category, I do not see how you can hold that position with respect to immigrants and not hold that position with respect to Rittenhouse, unless it's about race.
Yeah.
So
which it clearly is. And you know, of course the whole thing of like, we somehow hold a miscellaneous, unorganized group of civilians who are really upset about injustice, we hold them to a higher accountability threshold than the police, whose job it is to not kill people or should be to not kill people. I mean, there's so much in it that seems unjust to me. But let's get to, you know, what we want to talk about. We have a few comments. Yep. I want to ask you just kind of a catch-all question, though, because it's been now, you know, what, a week or two since this happened? It's hard to keep track of dates, but it's been a minute. A couple things. First off, I've seen a lot of people commenting places that the fact that Rittenhouse was breaking the law at the time means he cannot claim self-defense. And we addressed that a little bit on the episode, but I just wanted to clarify because I wonder if people are maybe using that too broadly, you know, because it's not as though it seems to me that it can't be true that if he's, you know, jaywalking at the time, someone can just hit him with a baseball bat and no self-defense because he was committing a crime. What's the line there? And can you clarify that? Was the fact that he was in illegal possession of this firearm, is that enough to say you're there's absolutely no self-defense? Someone can just attack you? Or is there a little more nuance there in terms of that argument?
Yeah. So you are 100% correct that there is nuance in that argument. And again, this varies state by state. But typically what happens is that there are the commission of certain statutory felonies will disqualify a person from being able to rely on self-defense while committing, attempting to commit, or escaping from the commission of said felonies, right? So like we said on the YouTube, you know, in our Q&A, the classic example of this is you and I go into knock off a 7-Eleven, you panic at the last moment and the shopkeeper shoots you while you're trying to run away. Not only neither you nor I get to shoot the shopkeeper in self-defense,
right?
But also I'm guilty of felony murder because I committed the felony and then you are dead as a result of it, even though you are my co-conspirator. That is, you know, it's
wait,
you're,
one of if the shopkeeper kills me, yep, you're guilty, yep, of murder?
Correct.
Whoa.
Because think about it, felony murder rule. I engaged in an activity committing a felony that resulted in your death. So yes, even though you and I were co-conspirators, if the shopkeeper blows you away, the shopkeeper has a defense of self-defense, and I do not, because we were in the commission of a disqualifying statutory felony. It is 100%, and this goes to the larger question that you've asked, right? A lot of people have shared a bunch of different, like, YouTube, you know, trying to, like, frame mm-hmm. by frame and argue self-defense. And the problem is that we do not have video of what yeah. happened before Rittenhouse started running away.
That's what
we
the
do
thing.
Have.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a police report that a protester was shot in the back multiple times. Okay. Now, again, everyone is guilty until everyone's guilty. Everyone is innocent until yeah. proven guilty.
And this, right? It was a shot in the back. There's a shot in the groin. There's a shot in different places. So, you know, we don't know for
and
certain
so
what's
going on. We do not know that those came from Rittenhouse's firearm. But if they did, and this is all that we're saying, if they did, that plainly negates the claim of self-defense when people are running after him and trying to tackle him. And the idea that folks are piling on with supposed sympathy right now is kind of shocking, because the same folks who are now saying, well, look, like, you know, they're trying to, like, take him down with a skateboard. These are the people who keep saying every time there's a school shooting, like, well, I don't understand. Why don't the victims try and tackle the shooter? Well, that's what happened here, right? The victims tried to, again, if the video, you know, from what we can tell, it looks like the victims tried to tackle the shooter before he could get away. And to then focus in on that second period, you know, the yeah. one that you're claiming people should do, and then say, well, you know, that then gives rise to self-defense. That's nonsense.
So there's a couple levels. Yeah. I want to differentiate. There is the total troll POS. One of the worst people in the planet, I mean this with all sincerity, is Andy Ngo, someone I actually yeah. met back at the Sargon debate before. He was just a student at Portland back then, I think, and was like covering
it. Yeah, you posed with him, right?
And yeah, apparently. Yeah, yeah. I had no idea. He was just a student. There's no reason I would have known that he would later become one of the worst people in the history of the world. But he really is one of the worst people in the planet. There's that level where they're like, look at this awful, he made up. He actually fabricated or grabbed it from somebody else who fabricated. I guess I'll, you know, I don't know. But he shared a totally fabricated, like, sex registry hit on one of the victims and said he was a sex offender, which was not true. And people, like, shared the same search criteria for the guy's name and were like, when I do this, nothing comes up. Yet in your screenshot, it does. You know, like, what the hell, man? He is awful. He and people like that. So there's one level where they're saying, look, this evil sex offender with a skateboard tried to attack him. like as though he would have known that the guy had a record somehow, like that makes any difference. And so there's that level. Now, we all know, anyone who is at all rational knows that the skateboard guy, who was a hero, by the way, tried to take him out after he had already killed somebody. We all know that. But I will say there is a level of uncertainty around the first killing, because the anywhere that I've seen as of now, and I've tried to seek this out, we don't exactly know why the first group of people was pursuing him. There was a first one or two or three people that were kind of chasing him, and a guy throws like a plastic bag toward him or something. We don't know why that was. And it's not fair to say, so I'm just clarifying, it's not fair to say that that was after he killed somebody. That wasn't after he killed somebody that we know of, unless there's like another victim or something that just hasn't come up. But I don't think there is. So we don't know. Maybe he threatened them. Maybe he, who knows what it was. He was being kind of chased. Now, I do not still think, I want to get your opinion on this, Andrew. I still do not think the proper response to having a plastic bag thrown at you is murder, but I'm not the lawyer. What do you think?
I think you're the lawyer enough on that one.
So, but I do want to clarify, because I think it gets mixed around, you know, and people are, I want to make sure we're responding to the correct part. If anyone is arguing that he was attacked with a skateboard and that's why he killed somebody, they're just flat out wrong. They're making a terrible argument that was after he already killed somebody. But we still don't entirely know about the first thing. And by the way, even if you want to go in, and I want to ask you this as a question, Andrew, even if you say you put the facts totally in Rittenhouse's corner on that, hypothetically, I want to totally signal that this, we don't know this, but like, let's say under the best of circumstances for Rittenhouse, that he was under some sort of attack initially. He kills a person and then he continues running away with a gun. And instead of like dropping the firearm, you know, or like surrendering or anything like that, he kills another person and shoots another person. Even under the greatest of facts there, he would still be guilty of homicide, right?
Oh, yeah. He would still be guilty of at least one statutory homicide under Wisconsin law. The real question there, and this overlaps with, you know, we've talked about, you know, stand your ground laws and the like, but
yeah, stand someone else's ground laws.
Right. Well, and that's really, really important to identify here. At common law, the reason, just to reiterate, the reason that some states have stand your ground laws is that at common law, you had a duty to retreat from a situation that began with serious risk of imminent bodily harm, under which self-defense is justified, but then de-escalates, right? So again, think about it. Guy pulls out a knife in a bar fight. You pull out a gun, and then the guy with the knife like backs off and is right. Like, okay, all right, man. Like and then you shoot him anyway, right? No, at that point that he's put the knife away, you have a duty to retreat, to de-escalate the situation. Some people didn't like that. And there are related doctrines, including the common law, the castle doctrine, you know, the mm-hmm. person's home is their castle, right? You have no duty to retreat from your own home, which is the case in some states. Or that has then been supplemented, right? Because you can supersede the common law rules with a statute. And that's where most of the stand your ground statutes come from, right? They replace the common law duty to retreat with some modification that says, yeah, but in some circumstances, you don't have a duty to retreat. Let's be very, very clear. And again, I do not know where Wisconsin stands on having modified the common law duty to retreat. There is no state that I know of in which the duty to retreat is completely superseded, right? Which the bar fight example is not homicide, right? Because mm-hmm. we all agree with that, right?
Yeah. Like
somebody comes after you in a bar and all of a sudden it de-escalates. Well, you're not defending the bar.
Yeah.
Right? And same thing, right? Your home may be your castle, but you know, your a public street is not your castle. Somebody else's car dealership is not your castle. So yes.
Yeah.
is the answer to all of that. There may be some interaction. We have some, we have a good listener comment regarding self-defense in Wisconsin. But no, kind of put that all together. There certainly is nothing that I have seen that leads me to reconsider our conclusions in that show.
All right. Well, the president disagrees, by the way. We all knew that was coming. Let's get to our listener comment here. The first one we have says, "Hi, Thomas and Andrew. I've been a prosecutor for 5 years, and my husband was previously a prosecutor. While listening to episode 416, I couldn't help but take issue with your characterization of Wisconsin's self-defense statute. Wisconsin's statute, while worded slightly weirdly, operates exactly like self-defense does in a majority of jurisdictions. The defendant bears the initial burden of presenting some evidence to support a self-defense claim, but once he does, the prosecution bears the burden of disproving the claim beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a majority rule. This is precisely what makes self-defense cases so difficult to prove." Okay. Yeah, I know you had a question about that at the time. So sounds like a prosecutor is saying this isn't much different than any other jurisdiction.
Yeah, that's exactly what she said, and I looked it up, and she's 100% right. And this is why I try and put error bars on, you know, when I'm opining about practice in criminal law. I make it very clear I am not a criminal attorney, and you know, I have a limited range of experience with that. I'm going to link a case in the show note: United States versus Thomas, 34 F3rd 44 from the Second Circuit from 1994. That is illustrative. That says it's not just at the state level in virtually every state, but also at the federal level that the court, and this is how this comes out, is it in how the judge issues instructions to the jury, right? And so in this case, the defendant successfully challenged the jury instructions as being insufficient, that the government has the burden of disproving self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt once it is raised by a defendant. So she's right and I'm wrong. There's a little bit of a nuance to that. But no, thank you. That, like, we put out the call. I asked, and I really, really appreciate the, being so informed.
Asked and answered, as you might say.
Indeed.
All right. So that's, everything that we see as an update on Wisconsin. I mean, so just for the record, Andrew, YouTuber after YouTuber aside, who seems to have some special Zapruder film analysis of what's going on, you stand by what we've said. There's nothing new has come out that suggests this was anything other than what we already said it was.
Yeah. And again, I think it's always good. I appreciate the nuance with which you described your position. You know, like, I think we try to be open about this, but yeah, I concur.
All right. We have one more listener comment. It is on a different topic, though. And J.A. writes, "In OA 415, you stated that DeJoy purchased Amazon options in June after selling off his Amazon stock. While true, the purchase of the options appears to be just a closing of a previous position in the market. This means he used to own a covered call option. Basically, he shorted the stock, but hedged his bet by purchasing stock as well. So probably the ethics team at USPS told him to divest from all his Amazon positions. So he, one, sold all the Amazon stock he owned, and two, closed all the options positions he owned, meaning he had to purchase back the calls he initially sold, even if it means a loss. Thus, he now owns zero financial interest in Amazon, whether stock or calls. Unfortunately, I cannot find DeJoy's USPS periodic transaction report, PTR, but the existence of the PTR is mentioned in this letter from Crew, who did appear to incorrectly read his disclosure as well. Walter Schaub does make it clear that if DeJoy was telling the truth about not having a financial interest in Amazon, he did a bad job of both reporting it that way and clearing up the confusion. So Andrew was probably wrong, but so was everyone else. And this still doesn't make DeJoy a good person, and his XPO holdings are highly suspect." Okay, so that clears. So you were confused about, you know, whether or not he still had, that makes sense. So he had a position, a short position. So therefore, you know, it looked like he was buying stock, but really was just closing that position, I guess.
And so I would have read this this email from listener J.A. regardless, but this is such a great email. Number one, because he found and went through the underlying Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, the CREW document, mm-hmm. that I was using as the factual basis for my analysis, right? Because, right. again, I trust those folks. I looked at it. They said X. Went to exactly the source that I was using. All of this seems plausible to me. And I do want to piggyback that we learned the end of last week that the U.S. Postal Service, this is from a report in the New York Times, has paid $286 million over the past 7 years to XPO Logistics, which is the holdings that Louis DeJoy did not divest himself of. Hmm. He holds at least a $30 million stake in the company, ramping up its business with the Postal Service since he took the helm. So drain the swamp. But no, look, like it's important to be correct about the replacing the call position. It is also important to say, every piece of evidence we have is that Louis DeJoy is impermissibly conflicted from serving in the position in which he now serves, which is to say he is a typical Trump appointee. So there you go. But I love the email. And, and I think he's right. It makes sense.
Yeah.
So we can't quite tell because, as he points out, I've been unable to find the PTR either. But, you know, Walter Schaub is a Republican lawyer, but like Walter Schaub is a government ethics lawyer. I trust them. I think that it is correct. It seems very plausible to me, and I'm happy to do that as a correction on my end.
Got the best listeners. Thanks. That's a great clarification. Good detective work. Thanks so much for writing in. We appreciate it. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Policy Genius. I know you already know this, of course, but September is National Life Insurance Awareness Month. You're telling me, Thomas, I already have the float made. I'm already celebrating the awareness of life insurance for National Life Insurance Awareness Month. I know. But just in case you're one of the few who didn't know that, now you know. And with everything going on, some people aren't aware of whether or not it's even possible to buy life insurance right now. Well, it is possible. It's still easy to shop for life insurance. It's something I did a couple years back. I've been telling you that every time that we have this ad because I'm still happy that I did it. And if you have loved ones depending on your income, you should as well do what I did and get life insurance. Here's how you do it. Head to policygenius.com. In minutes, you can work out how much coverage you need and compare quotes from top insurers to find your best price. Step 2, apply for your lowest price. Step 3, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork, all the red tape. And that's it. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance company. So if you hit any speed bumps during the application process, they'll take care of everything. They even have policies which allow eligible customers to skip the in-person medical exam and do it over the phone. That's the kind of service that has earned Policy Genius a 5-star rating across over 1,600 reviews on Trustpilot and Google. So, if you need life insurance, head to policygenius.com right now to get started. You could save $1,500 or more a year by comparing quotes on their marketplace. Policy Genius, when it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. Down. The law. Down. The law. Down. The law. Down. The law. All right, well, I think we're going to have to cancel Eminent Domain, Andrew, but we are going to get to McGirt v. Oklahoma. I know you've wanted to talk about this for a while. Give us the Andrew Torres signature breakdown here.
Yeah, I want to go through because I think there's a lot of hyperbole about this case. It is stoked by people like Ted Cruz saying things that are ridiculous. Again, Ted Cruz, year ahead of me at Harvard Law School, when this decision came down, said on Twitter, quote, Neil Gorsuch and the four liberal justices just gave away half of Oklahoma, literally, Manhattan is next, end of quote. which is the most perfect Ted Cruz moment of feigning stupidity in order to be racist.
I'm surprised he always sneaks in latte sipping, soy latte. There's always a coffee drink in his tweets. Ooh. I'm surprised he didn't, you know, slip that one in. I guess but try harder next time to get one in there. A frappuccino drinking. Also, why go for Manhattan? Like, if you're trying to scare the Republican base, pick not. I feel like you know, Manhattan, they're going to be like, oh, okay, that's
no,
fine.
No, I think that's right. Like, I think he wanted to be racist more than he wanted to play to his base, right? Like, oh, okay. Again, yeah. that is indirectly playing to his base. But seriously, like, because when you start to unpack that, right, like, everyone knows, right, the sale of Manhattan, like, cannot possibly be justified under any reasonable legal theory, right? Now, the question then becomes, what do you do about that? But, like, yeah, it's mind-boggling to me. So you have that kind of hyperbole. I'm going to explain where I think that comes from. I will also say our friend Devin, Legal Eagle himself, did a really great YouTube breakdown that I'm going to try make sure we cover different areas. But his stuff was great, and we'll link his video in the show notes because he covered this. One of the few things he managed to cover before we did. So he did a good job. Now, what happened in this case? This case involves a member of the Creek Nation. And I should add, I'm going to read from the decision when it comes to the language that is used. And this is an area where I do. If you are an Indian law scholar, and that's how it's referred to in practice areas, right? So in other words, Native American is I think common parlance. Most lawyers I know who practice Indian law refer to it as Indian law as opposed to Native American law. Some of these treaties and statutes, right, are from the 19th century. So I'm just going to use that language. If I've done something wrong, please do write in and let me know. If I've done something right, please do write in and let me know. So, member of the Creek Nation, Jimcy McGirt, J-I-M-C-Y, M-C-G-I-R-T. Think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Committed 3 serious sexual offenses in the state of Oklahoma, specifically in eastern Oklahoma, arguing that he was on Creek Reservation lands. By the way, already did an instant wrong. Jimcy was a member of the Seminole Nation. Seminole tribe and not the Creek tribe. So the actions took place on what he claimed were Creek lands. And he was convicted in an Oklahoma state court of those 3 serious sexual offenses. I will add parenthetically that this is a real and underreported problem on native land throughout the United States, is sexual abuse of women by men who believe that they are falling into a legal gray area. That's not what this case is about, but that's a real problem endemic in the literature. Now, the question is, could McGirt legally be tried in state court in Oklahoma if he committed those offenses on Creek lands? And the answer to that is kind of complicated. That's how it got to the Supreme Court. It has to do with an 1885 law called the Major Crimes Act. And here, I'm going to quote from the statute. It's 18 U.S.C. 1153A, still on the books today, right? 135 years later. It says, within the Indian country, put a pin in that, any Indian who commits certain offenses, which include the sexual offenses at issue here, against the person or property of another Indian or any other person, shall be subject to the same law and penalties as all other persons committing any of the above offenses within the exclusive jurisdiction of the United States. Okay, so let's unpack that a little bit. What that means is that if you commit one of those serious crimes on Indian land, then you are subject, you must be tried in federal rather than state courts. You can under, and there are a lot of historical reasons for passing that. So the question then is, was McGirt properly tried in state court, or should he have been tried in federal court? Right. So that at the outset is, I think, a really, really important distinction to know, that, like, again, the remedy here for McGirt would not be he gets to go free. The remedy is he has to be tried in a federal court, and he can't be tried in a state court. And you can understand, right, historically, why that would be a significant protection to Native Americans.
So it's not as though this person is necessarily trying to do like a get out of jail with this one weird trick. I mean, he would still...
He's been convicted, so it would overturn his state conviction, and then he could still be tried in federal court. Okay. Again, if you've been convicted of very serious crimes, you'd like to try again.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And the law is crystal clear that states do not have jurisdiction to try Indians for conduct committed in Indian country. So now we ask, and again, this is where I said, oh, okay, I'm reading you a term from 1885. What's Indian country? Well,
yeah.
Again, we go to the statute. It defines it. It says, quote, Indian country is, quote, all land within the limits of any Indian reservation under the jurisdiction of the United States government, notwithstanding the issuance of any patent and including rights of way running through the reservation. Now, what the hell does the patent thing have to do with anything in the middle of that? Right? And the answer to that has to do with the fact that real property law makes up crazy words that are left over from 13th century Saxony that make no sense. And this is actually referring to a land patent. And a land patent is what we would just call a conveyance from one party to another, where the party that owns the land is a sovereign, right? Is a state, right? So when the state owns the land, it is called a land patent when it grants that land to you because the state owns it. But notice, right, the state doesn't own a whole lot of land, right? Most property in this country is private property. So that's why the term land patent like seems weird, and also because we use patent to mean like, you know, the patent for the device, you know, for how to build this particular widget. So weird word. But now when you understand what a land patent is, think of what that means. That means Indian country is anything that is within an Indian reservation, even if the Indian government has divested portions of that land from itself as a sovereign to individuals. And that's really important. Obviously, we don't nearly have time to go through the history of that. But like getting Indian country to take land that was held in common and divvy it out to individuals was also part of the strategy of breaking up Indian land over the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, right? So that happened a lot throughout Oklahoma, right? Large swaths of the Indian reservations were patented off to various tribal members. And the Major Crimes Act says, yeah, you can do that. That doesn't make the whole overall territory not Indian territory. What does make Indian territory not Indian territory? The answer to that, and this is the real, like, look, there's a lot to like about this opinion. And there's a lot to say, like, oh, hey, maybe we are moving forward with respect to indigenous peoples. If you're tempted to feel that way, remember that the United States Congress can, quote, disestablish an Indian reservation.
Wow.
And that means exactly what it says, that if there is an act of Congress, we can say, yeah, I know we gave that to you as an Indian reservation. No, it isn't anymore. We have disestablished it. We have therefore abolished it. Sorry about that. Even if there's a pre-existing treaty, too bad.
That seems a little unfair.
Yeah, it kind of does, huh? So now, armed with that knowledge, We can parse through whether and how McGirt's claims get analyzed, right? So the first question is, was there a reservation? and you might think like that's a super easy question, and it is, but the dissent in this case, piggybacking on the argument that the state of Oklahoma made, tried to argue that there was never an Indian reservation in Oklahoma to begin with. And again, as Neil Gorsuch, and he's, you know, now two for two where in breaking from what you might expect, has engaged in, you know, sort of surprisingly sympathetic language, you know, recounts a little bit of the, you know, AP US history of the Trail of Tears, right? Like, the reason that there were massive, that there are massive Indian reservations in Oklahoma is because we kicked the Indians out of all of the desirable southern states that they were in at the beginning of the 19th century and forced them west via the Trail of Tears into Oklahoma. So claiming, there's not a reservation in Oklahoma, again, actually, like, struck the majority as kind of surprising, right? Here's how Gorsuch's language, right? This begins on page 28, section 4, in describing the argument. Gorsuch says, "Even if we were to accept Oklahoma's bold feat of reclassification, it is hardly clear that the state would win this case." What is the bold feat of reclassification? To say that the litany of promises made from 1832 onward in connection with the Trail of Tears did not actually establish a reservation, but only, quote, a dependent Indian community, end of quote. That was actually what was argued in this case. And then Gorsuch says, "Reservations and Indian allotments, the Indian titles to which have not been extinguished, qualify as Indian country under the statute, but dependent Indian communities also qualify as Indian countries under subsection B. So it makes no difference." And then when faced with that, Gorsuch says, "Oklahoma's answer gets more surprising. The reason that the Creeks' lands are not a reservation, we're told, is that the Creek Nation originally held fee title," right? That is, they owned the property outright. "Recall that the Indian Removal Act authorized the president not only to solemnly assure the tribe that the United States will forever secure and guarantee to them the country so exchanged with them, but also, if they prefer it, the United States will cause a patent or grant to be made and executed to them for the same. Recall that when the Creek insisted on this additional protection when negotiating the Treaty of 1833, and in fact received a land patent pursuant to that treaty some 19 years later. In the eyes of Oklahoma, the tribe's choice on this score was a fateful one. By asking for and receiving fee title to their lands, the Creek inadvertently made their tribal sovereignty easier to divest rather than harder," right? So parsing all of that, Gorsuch is saying, essentially, Oklahoma is arguing one weird trick, right? In 1833, the Creek are asked for, "We want to own all of our property." And they're now saying, "Ah, because you own all the property, you don't, you own that in a grant from the government, so you don't have sovereignty over it."
Wow.
Yeah. And Gorsuch says, makes no sense. He says, "Admittedly, the Creek's arrangement was different because the tribe held fee simple title and not the usual Indian right of occupancy, which again is a lesser property right. But the land was reserved from sale in the very real sense that the government could not give the tribal lands to others or appropriate them for its own purposes without engaging in an act of confiscation. It's hard to see how any difference between these two arrangements might work to the detriment of the tribe." Okay. So there's a reservation. The next question is, was that reservation disestablished by the Congress? And this is the meat of the decision. And again, why we have Gorsuch joining the court's liberals. Gorsuch's argument is super simple. He says, to disestablish, Congress has to pass a law. And the law has to say, "I know the treaty says X, but, you know, too bad, we're disestablishing that reservation." Congress never did. Words mean what they say. And therefore,
case closed.
Case closed. That's what he says. Therefore, much of eastern Oklahoma remains Indian reservations under the Treaty of 1832, subsequent treaties. The argument to the contrary that is raised in the Roberts dissent are really twofold, right? The legal argument is that the subsequent conduct should be treated as an effective disestablishment, Right. Yeah. Okay. We get it. Congress didn't really never abolished the official reservations that belonged to the five nations. But, you know, Oklahoma's kind of behaved as if white people own those lands. So we should, you know, view it that way. And in particular, this goes back to the part of the technical argument that was made here was the fact that that tribal lands were granted via land patent to private individuals. But again, right. The plain language of the statutes, the Major Crimes Act says, yeah, you can do that. And that doesn't no longer make it your land, right? Like it's still Indian territory unless Congress says it isn't. And Congress didn't say that it wasn't. So, yeah, get it. Seems kind of weird. Seems kind of counterintuitive. But, you know, John Roberts, what are you doing making these arguments that are like, well, the intent was kind of, you know, like where is your constant, you know, where is your strict constructionism now is almost, you know, the it's certainly the subtext. It's almost the text of the majority opinion. The Roberts dissent makes a second argument. And again, it's a curious argument to see Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas signing on to, but it is basically a, you can't be serious about this. All kinds of crazy, terrible things will happen if we say that Oklahoma no longer owns the eastern half of Oklahoma. And if it seems like I'm being unfair, start off at page 9 of the Roberts dissent. Right. And the virtually the entirety of the rest of dissent are to say, yeah. OK, you might be right about what the law means, but think about all of the consequences here. Quote, but if that is the right approach, what have we been doing all these years? Every single one of our disestablishment cases has considered extratextual sources, and in doing so, none has required the identification of ambiguity in a particular term. That is because, while it is well established that Congress's intent must be clear, in this area, i.e., governing laws about brown people, we have expressly held that the appropriate inquiry does not focus on the statutory text alone. Again, I'm reading that with a little bit of sarcasm. Opening arguments, listeners can chuckle. You can chuckle. That dry language says, yeah. I know I go on about the sanctity of the written text of the Constitution and its original meaning. But like, come on. And it's an astonishing thing to see. It's plainly inconsistent with the articulated jurisprudence of Roberts, Kavanaugh, Alito, and Thomas in this dissent that basically just says if you need to be cognizant of the consequences that will happen if we declare the eastern half of Oklahoma to be an Indian reservation. And then, you know, you have 20 pages of, you know, well, who knows, you know, what could happen. And that really does get us to, and so that gets us to why this case was characterized this way and what happens. As OA listeners know, the court only has the power to award the relief to the parties that are in front of it for the claims that they have raised, right? Mm-hmm. And here, that relief is to McGirt, saying that his crime took place on what is defined as Indian lands for purposes of the Major Crimes Act of 1885. And therefore, he is entitled to a trial in federal court and to have his state court convictions vacated. Does that have implications for what comes next? It certainly has implications for what comes next, and it has implications for other lands throughout the country. But it does not begin to establish, right, that now, you know, your maps.
Yeah, it's not like the maps that you teach kids with are going to have a hole in the middle of the country or something.
Correct. Because, again, this is one of the difficulties of Indian law is that while there is both tribal sovereignty and U.S. sovereignty within the United States, right? And so the questions of how those two come into play, right, are things that we're going to have to sort out. But it does not become its own separate nation subject to no U.S. law, thanks to McGirt. Here's what does happen, right? And again, the reaction to McGirt, I will say, has mostly, because what I wanted to find out was, how do members of the Five Nations, right, how do Native Americans feel about this decision? And by and large, they feel positive about the decision. They've had a positive reaction to it. They've said, you know, this brings issues to the forefront, and that the approach taken by the majority, right, of saying, hey, we're not going to allow equitable considerations on the part of, like, oh, but what about the poor displaced white people in Oklahoma, take precedence over the plain requirements of statutes, treaties, and laws. I want to drop a parenthetical. There's nothing inconsistent with liberals wanting to join that approach too, right? Like the liberal approach is always, yes, laws mean what they say, consistent with both the principles that are behind those laws and the specifics about how those principles are to be implemented. And we should depart from them when the specifics would contradict the underlying principles. And here, the idea is that the underlying principle was to grant more, not fewer, protections to Native Americans as they were being exterminated and forced out of their homes on the Trail of Tears. So the idea that you would want to supplement that with a public policy reason that doesn't benefit Native Americans is bonkers, right? Like, and you can, like, in other words, you can be a consistent liberal, you can be a consistent non-textualist and say, yeah, I would sign on to the majority opinion in this. So I want to, you know, bracket that parenthetical right there. Here's the effect of the McGirt decision. One, it means that, and this is why we use this for the show graphic, Oklahoma recognizes the reservations for the five tribes within its jurisdiction. You can see the graphic on that. Those five tribes are the Cherokee, the Creek, the Seminole, the Choctaw, and the Chickasaw, right? So five nations have lands. It's a significant portion, right? It's greater than 50% of eastern Oklahoma that includes part of the city of Tulsa, right? So yes. Secondly, it means that Oklahoma cannot sentence tribal citizens to the death penalty for crimes that they commit on their reservations, because the Major Crimes Act does not provide for the death penalty. Oklahoma does provide for the death penalty under state law. And Oklahoma executes more people per capita than any state. That came as a bit of a shock to me. Yeah, I would have thought Texas would be in the lead on that, but their population is so big that I guess Oklahoma manages to get through. It means that the state of Oklahoma cannot prosecute crimes where either the victim or the perpetrator is Native American, right? That those crimes are now federal crimes. It means that tribal citizens who live on the reservation and work for their tribe do not have to pay state income tax. Okay.
Cool.
Now, yeah, notice how narrow that is, right? It does not mean that Oklahoma can't collect taxes for Indians who work for anything else in eastern Oklahoma. But it does mean that if you are confined to working for the tribe, for the tribal government, that's sovereign. And we cannot tax citizens of a sovereign nation for income earned in service to a sovereign nation. There are two things that it doesn't interact with that I think that are really, really important to bring out here. Right? The first is, this does not render Eastern Oklahoma a lawless zone for non-tribal members, right? If a non-tribal member commits a crime against a non-tribal member on tribal land, the state of Oklahoma can still prosecute those people, right? In other words, it's not like, oh, well, I'm out of the state's jurisdiction. You know, and again, this illustrates the fact that Native American sovereignty is different than, you know, like if we bordered Canada, right, which we do, right? If you're in Canada, the U.S. government cannot prosecute U.S. citizens for crimes committed in Canada, unless Canada decides to extradite them back to the U.S. for some reason, right? But if you're just a non-native person in Oklahoma and you commit a crime in Tulsa against another non-native resident, yeah, Oklahoma can still prosecute you. So that's point one. And point two is the Violence Against Women Act of 2013 allows tribes to prosecute non-Indians for abuse that for certain kinds of domestic abuse and sexual offenses that occur on Indian land. And that is the pin that I had put in at the beginning of this discussion, which is that prior to the passage of VAWA in 2013, there was a significant issue with non-tribal members committing sexual offenses on tribal lands. And Native Americans wanted the authority to prosecute for those offenses that occurred against their people on their lands. So that's all of the interaction so far, way less drastic than you might have suspected. It certainly does the way in which Native speakers have described this is basically like beginning to open up the dialogue and beginning to bring their issues out into the forefront. And I think that that's right, right? Like it hopefully will do a little better this time around than the country did in the 19th century. But
A low bar.
Well, yeah. I don't want to do an Andrew was but wrong.
We're a low country. Yeah.
Well, yes, we are.
Interesting. So Gorsuch, this is one of those stories where, you know, seems like he came through. Does this mean he's part of the liberal contingent of the Supreme Court?
No, it means that Neil Gorsuch, we've talked about this with respect to prior cases, right? It means that Neil Gorsuch means what he says when he says that I am a textualist. The law means the plain language of the law itself. In 95 to 99% of cases, right, that will dovetail with reaching a conservative outcome. In a handful of cases, it doesn't, right? So we talked about Gorsuch joining with the liberals in the Title VII cases, right, to say, oh, because of sex means because of sex. So look, I still don't agree that that's how you ought to interpret the Constitution. But if that's how you're going to interpret the Constitution, at least he's not Sam Alito, right? At least he's not Sam Alito, who's like, well, I'm a textualist, and unless it would mean something that could be adverse to white people, which is only a slightly unfair way of reading the dissent, right? Like it's awfully close to the policy argument that is advanced in the Roberts dissent. So yeah, I continue to think that that is facile and ahistorical and wrong, but I'd rather have somebody who at least applies that consistent. Yeah, yeah. Right. Than somebody who says, who takes all of, you know, who takes that 95 to 99% and then also jettisons it when, you know, whenever convenient, which by the way, is what the entire right wing contingent does with respect to the concept of stare decisis, which of course is an ongoing hobby horse here at Opening Arguments, but we don't have time for that. So
we are way out of time. And you know what that means? It's time to move on.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats over on patreon.com/law. Enjoying all the goodies, everything we always mention. Definitely sign up. It's a good time. Andrew, start us off.
Yeah, thank you to Matt Rogers for Virginia's 47th House District. Yeah, we have to go check that out, but thank you. At Casa Agria is the best brewery. At Emperor's Brewery is a close second. And guys, I can't adjudicate either of those until you send me some beer. So get on that. Stoic Paralegal, The Great Dooku Tree, Thomas Kleberg, Mary Perez, Buddy Guyerson, Amicus Finch, I Won't Tell Another Dicta Joke Until Trump Is Out of Office, Re-Elect Senator Doug Jones. Yeah, if we could do that, that would be amazing. Oh, Clown Horn, I'm actually starting law school, and we have not forgotten you. We're going to do that episode. I don't know when I'll hear this episode, as I'm heading off on a long-distance unicycle ride across New Jersey. Well, bring headphones.
Wear ear pods, yeah. What are you talking about? What else are you doing on a unicycle? Juggling? Even then, you can still...
Yeah, stick them in. Two fabulous lesbians who were wondering how many weeks in a row you were going to congratulate us on being married. Well, I guess three or four, so... William Drew Collins, wearing a Trump hat voids my respect for your religious beliefs. Bob Newhouse, sassy Italy Tours is not going to give Steve Bannon a refund on that Grappa tour he's not going to be able to make now. Good for you. Greg Kreimer, the Pauly Shore experience. I now possess that which you most fear. You will do my bidding or taste my wrath. Register every person you know to vote. Mongo and Duchess 2024. I guess Murder Hornets were just a filler episode. Cheeky Breaky, we need a new movement solely focused on justice against all those responsible for this fascist coup attempt. Mike Hall. Sigh. Editing this name is a pain in the ass and my best gags keep getting lost. Patreon, get with the program. Fly like a hot dog, Freedom Eagle. Say it with me, Amicus. Angry Macface, Matthew McConaughey, portraying Matthew McConaughey. Long time ago, me and my brother Kyle here, we was hitchhiking down a long run lonesome road. Stop. Ask a question the president of Finland would ask. Center Black Trans Sex Workers, The Books That Burn podcast, reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. Postal Police, stamping out crime since 1775. Good for you. Vote early if you can. This episode brought to you by the letter Q for quarantine. Maybe Patreon will save this name change. It did. Bar question. A televangelist is thinking about Alanis Morissette and walking around naked in his living room. When the police... ... Change my Patreon name so that I don't jump every time you read it. I think that was one of the screaming ones. Make Steve King an author again. Our Spanish football club lawyers, experts in real property. I love that. Murray Gregerson in Illinois. We pronounce it Illinois. Andrew is my favorite undeclared congressional candidate. Thomas is a close second. Don't have a cow, Naomi Rao. Just let Flynn go to prison. Gonna have to buy a whole library of stamps. Symbol Infinity. Symbol Infinity. Ian Buckley, putting a pin in this patron name for later. Jake Braun, not that Chris Wallace. I'm too sexy to vote Trump, too sexy to vote Trump. Trump needs to be reimpeached. I'm a lawyer, you know what I mean, when I, and then I assume that was more Right Said Fred lyrics. Christopher Brown, Kylo v. U.S. is really about Scalia growing his own weed. Lawful Copter says Bannon looks like a guy who just had his second-to-last Horcrux destroyed. I get that joke, although I've never read the Harry Potter books. Yeah, GiveToModestNeeds.org. GiveToModestNeeds.org. That's a good idea. The wheels of justice turn faster than the speed I change my Patreon name. Support the co-op economy. Various goat noises. There's a goat. Why is there a goat? Andrew Seidel's butt wants a competent government. Vote Biden. It does indeed. Let me drink lots of water. I like peeing totally clear. My satanic drag name is the Panty Christ. That's a good one. Zirkle, who allowed this man, this pathetic man, this man who could not outwit a used teabag, to be in a position where he might endanger? And then I don't know the rest of the quote. I know the quote, but I can't do it from memory. Odin wants you to vote for Joe Biden and convince others to vote for Joe Biden. Indeed. Terry Cannon, Polly Hernandez, the previous patron name is true. The next patron name is false. I want more briefs. Stocking up on lung injectable bleach, Emily Rainbow Spence, Mongo's back, baby. Have deep feelings for OA. Just need to find new job in Game of Life. Well, welcome back, Mongo. Don't go punching any horses. Internet Explorer votes for a Boston live show. I love the city of Boston, and yeah, I want us to get
I
out there.
I hate all their sports team, but
well, sure, obviously. Yeah. I mean, that's where we're in agreement on that, and watching the Red Sox be 11-206.
That's why I picked Boston to win it all in the NHL opening arguments bracket challenge, and I will proudly lose for a second year in a row.
We lose more patrons every time we do that, but I'm with you. All right. Jason Kopas, Hotspur's Ari Chazan is almost but not quite entirely unlike a lawyer. Punching fascists is not enough. Get into good trouble. Take donation advice from a podcast. FFRF, EFF, ACLU, Modest Needs, and our own damn Patreon. I've got a fever, and the only prescription is more triangle. Exceptional. Take it away, Thomas.
All right. Nate Drex, make America great again, again. V. Frank, 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. Save the USPS. They are essential for small businesses and our democracy. Volunteer for your candidate today and take back your government. Jennifer Kratch, Diogenes the Cynic was right. J. Cheever Loophole, Jeff Galback, John Bilderback. Happy birthday to my sweetest honey bunny, Linda Jenkins. Wash your hands, then vote for Joe Biden. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Stephen Balticate Sandoval, it's like Comcast Internet glitches on the first day of remote school. If I've said it once, I've said it a thousand times. Keeping this name for the next 1998 episodes. Philip Kaiser, Andrea the Arbitrary and Capricious, Eric Alsman. I like traffic lights. Stop equivocating. They're not the same. Vote Biden. Okay. Baseball law states 2020 doesn't count. Well, only if, you know, the Astros or somebody like that wins, but I don't think they're going to. Crucifixion is a faithful execution. Absion, stop, throw the grenade like a lawyer would throw. Payne's trumpet. Trambolis, Therese Chan, La Machine Infernale, or something, I don't know. The Wandering Gambler, a world without simile wouldn't be like anything. I support the Australian Republican movement. No, not those Republicans. Milo Mead song stands in solidarity with UW nurses and their union. SCOTUS uses the Bob's Country Bunker model of religious tolerance. Death Escrow Karaoke, only songs by dead artists. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Wait, wrong list. Those are the protesters outside the RNC. James K. Ah, breath. Ah. Chad T. Anonymous. Two, completely drained and depressed and pissed off at left, right, and center to come up with a joke this week. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Impeach Thomas's penguin? Never. Hope you all are safe and well. Have a good week. Closing concessions, Airbud 69, it's better to give and retrieve. Maybe the real emoluments violations are the bribes we received along the way. Liz witnesseth me weeks. Derek, this episode by the Donald Trump felony of the day desk calendar for sale whenever wherever you buy a cup fefe. Adam Costa, J. Aldenwalt, big easy blasphemy. B equals D. A string of unpronounceable characters. Rhonda 2020, because WTF not. Cobalt the Dead Pitbull has a new adopted younger brother, Chocolate Chip Cookie the Living Pitbull. Oh, good. My superpower is knowing the difference between Bill Pullman and Bill Paxton. Yep, no, I know. I firmly do, but I didn't know the difference between Terminator 1, Terminator 2. That was my problem. Malaika Chandler, Tricicular Manslaughter, Soggy Pants, Matthew Vernon, Heather L., adopt a homeless pet and opposed to clowning and ear docking, Sakashita Fukusumi, if the U.S. is turning into Handmaid's Tale, the U.K. is already Children of Men, the film, not the book. Okay. Don't take legal advice from Laser Beam Monstrosity, attorney at law. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Ali, David in Brooklyn, Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, if the RNC was a serial, it would be Oops, All Baddies, Mitchell, No Commute, So Behind on Podcasts, Flynn lost 8-2, and I'm really beginning to like Henderson less than Rao now. Sam Buck, Natasha Crunchwrap, wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute. I agree with that 100%. And finally, Conrad Michaels, champion of the ages. Whew, thank you so much, folks. We really appreciate you. I love the shout-outs. They're so much fun.
Yeah, indeed they are.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, it's time for T3BE answer time. We'll get to find out if all the suggestions I assume people sent me for something to play, if I get a question right, we'll get to find out if that matters yet or if, you know, there's still more time. Here we go.
Well, I am going to cut to the chase. We are going to play that brand new music. You got back on that hobby horse.
Yes.
Is that the right? With a real property question. So you guessed B. Answer was B. Let's go over the question again. This was a businesswoman owns two tracts of land, conveys one has a building on it. The other one is vacant. Conveys the vacant tract by a warranty deed to somebody else who then says, yeah, I'm going to use this as a nature preserve. that conveyance contained a covenant that said neither you nor your heirs or assigns would ever erect any building on the vacant tract in order to preserve the view from the other lot. The buyer says, yeah, I'll abide by that, purchases the lot, does so, records the deed. There's a red herring about not signing it, which doesn't matter at all.
I sussed that out as a powerful attorney that I am.
Yeah. Signature not matters. That does not matter. Grantee accepted the deed and recorded it. This is, and the term is given to you in the incorrect answer, answer C. Ah. This is an equitable servitude, which again, because real property has to use names that make no sense, like land patents. An equitable servitude is a restriction on a conveyance for certain public uses, like making a park, right? Mm-hmm. And the important thing here is that you narrowed it down to either B or C. So we said, right, the signature thing was
A was nonsense, right?
A, the businessman, because the commercial building was constructed after, or it was constructed before the cousin began his construction project. Yeah. High grade nonsense.
Okay, good. You never know with real property. One of these days, it'll be the right answer. But A was nonsense.
D, not relevant when the first building was constructed, because this is not done to preserve the rights of the people who work in the first building to have a good view. Right, that because that's kind of sort of what that implies, right? That says, oh yeah, the first building came around, and since they were first and they wanted the view, that's what counts. It has to do with when I own land and I convey that land, can I specify how I want that land to be conveyed? And the answer is, yes, you can. You can have an equitable servitude. You can say, I'm going to sell you this land, but only if you promise to make a park out of it. We want people to do that. And so then the question is, does an equitable servitude terminate upon the death of the promisor? And the answer to that is no. And that also makes perfect sense, right? Like, we wouldn't want you to be able to, like, get out
just
and be like,
buy something, then kill yourself.
You know, put up a straw.
It'd be a real, like, you know, Moriarty level plot there. You're not going to have your view, Sherlock. Anyway,
an equitable servitude must satisfy the statute of frauds. It must be in writing. The promise must, quote, touch and concern the land. So in other words, I can't say, like, I'm going to convey this land to you as you promise to attend the Methodist church for the rest of
it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, it's got to be with respect to the land and the subsequent parties to which they must be bound must be on notice of the conditions in the equitable servitude, which again, you sussed out what with 100%. You were like, yeah. Like, they recorded the deal. Like, it says it right there. You got to do, you know, you got to not erect a building on it. And that is, in fact, the case. You asked the question, like, is this going to, like, stay vacant for a million billion years? Yeah. And the answer to that is no. Like, what you do is you just, when you have an equitable servitude, means the way we were taught in law school to think about property that I think is actually super helpful is to not think about conveying property as picking up a thing and giving the thing from person A to person B, but to think of it like a big bundle of sticks, right? And there are lots of different uses of the property that are those sticks. So when you convey something in fee simple, you are conveying the entire bundle. You're saying, yep, all of the rights that I have in this property, all of the bundle of sticks, I'm packaging it up, putting a deed, it's called fee simple, that's the rubber band, and I'm giving you all my sticks. But you can convey less than the whole bundle, right?
Yeah.
I could sell you a right-of-way. I could sell you an easement.
So is there any way for the rest of the existence of this land on earth for someone to build a building on there? That was what I was worried about.
And here's the way, right, and here's the way that works. So person A sells to person B all the sticks but one, basically, right? Uh-huh. Like, and says, hey, you have You can do whatever you want.
So hypothetically, with this. The construction person still owns that stick right now, we're saying.
The original heirs of the businesswoman.
Yeah.
Now the businessman, right?
Right.
Owns that remaining stick. And the cousin could go back to the businessman and be like, oh, hey, man.
How much you want for that stick?
How much you want for that stick? Yeah. That's exactly right. And that's how real property resolves this. And if the businessman never sells the stick and his heirs never sell the stick, well, that's fine. Like that's, we live in a free country.
Yeah.
I never conveyed to you the right to build a building. I conveyed to you everything else about this piece of land.
If
you wanted more, you should have bought more and, you know, libertarian paradise. So there you go.
Huh? Stick law, everybody. Now he tells me, you know, hundreds of questions later. Now he gives me the secret formula for real property, which was stick law all along. Yeah,
think about that's this is absolutely right. So think about every real property question. Think about which sticks are being conveyed.
Well, anyway, I nailed this one. Play the new sound, me.
You are correct. The best kind of correct.
He's not even a lawyer when he's kicking your ass.
Andrew. Who's our big winner this week, besides me?
Well, Thomas, this week's winner is Nathaniel Richter on Twitter, who has an adorable screaming cat as their icon. And he says, T3BE, real property, always fun. I'm going to guess answer B. The agreement and recorded deeds were both plain in their intention for preservation. Unless something was improperly recorded, it should stick. Otherwise, what would preservation land grants be for? Reasonable analysis. I love the idea of applying common sense principles to 13th century Saxony law. And congratulations, Nathaniel, on being this week's winner. So everyone give him a follow. That is at forensic_ling, FORENSIC_LING on Twitter. Just look for the screaming kitty. And congratulations, Nathaniel, on being this week's winner.
All right, that's our show. Thanks very much so much for listening, everybody. We'll see you on Friday for Rapid Response, as always.
Until then.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law-talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.